Hey everybody, Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast. Thank you for tuning in to another brand new episode of the show. Today's features returning guest, my buddy, typewriter Tim. We had a great time hanging out at his home talking about, he's actually getting ready to jump on a motorcycle today and head across the country. We talk all about this adventure that he's getting ready to take off on. So yeah, sit back and enjoy this one. It's a lot of fun. Great conversation. A lot of interesting stuff came through in this one. Do want to remind you that Rock Paper Podcast is brought to you by Roughneck Beard Company and American Rambler, located here in St. Louis, Missouri, over in the Maplewood area. You can swing by their shop and pick up all your favorite all-natural beard oils, your beard balms. And, you know, it's warming up. It's summertime. Maybe check out their junk powder. Or one of my personal favorites, their Roughneck Beard Batter. Roughneck Beard Batter is the ultimate beard and skin moisturizer. It's a blend of 8 nutrient-rich soft oils whipped directly into unrefined shea butter for a moisturizing kick like no other. The highest amount of triglycerides and fatty acids available in the beard care market, hands down, world-renowned, but made right here in St. Louis. If you can't make it to the store, you can shop 24/7 at roughneckbeardcompany.com. Use my code RPP15 for an exclusive 15% off your entire purchase. And even if you don't have a beard, American Rambler's got you taken care of. You can visit them for all your grooming needs and pick up some wonderful locally sourced products and support local business. Also, big shout out to High All Sound for their continued support of this show and helping make everything sound great. Shop highallsound.com today and get yourself a brand new microphone. And if you also would like to help support this show, a great way to do so would be visiting the all-new Rock Paper Podcast merch store. Head on over to buyjack.com/rockpaperpodcast and check out the shirts, tank tops. We got some trucker snapback hats up there. Any of that stuff you sound interesting to you, check it all out there again at buyjack.com in the Rock Paper Podcast merch store. Your support means the world to me, so thank you, everybody. Again, we just passed 7 years of doing this show. It's crazy to think about, but I really appreciate you all sticking with me and helping me out, continuing to listen to this show. And if you need me, of course, everything's at rockpaperpodcast.com. Hit me up on the email, rockpaperpodcast@gmail. And the socials, with all that out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode with typewriter Tim.
Podcast is kind of like a, it's like a radio show that's not on the radio. It's on the internet. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's also like my mom. It makes it sound more confusing, doesn't it? It sounds like this.
This is Typewriter Tim in St. Louis, Missouri, and you're listening to Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Scissors beat paper, paper covers rock. Rock beat scissors, Shane covers nonstop. Never know what new kind of guests that he's got coming at you. Live and direct on the spot. Could be rock, folk, country, or hip-hop, jazz. Kind of folks that he has. Could be an artist or a comedian to make you laugh on the
Rock Paper Podcast.
Double decker fudge round, rolling round town. Shane coming at you live and direct from ground zero. He's your hero, he's your bestie. Rock Paper Podcast with Shane Presley.
Paper Podcast.
Hey everybody, Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri. Yo. Hanging out with returning guest Tim Jordan, aka Typewriter Tim.
Yo, what's up everybody?
Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Oh man, you know I love this show, man.
This is super cool, man. I haven't seen you in quite a while. I know you moved for a while, and
I keep trying to move, yeah. But the universe is moving me.
Yeah.
You know, tried to move to Kansas. That didn't work. Didn't know what I was going to do. That didn't work. And then the world, I mean, how do you describe what happened?
Sure.
Fell apart, whatever. And that put me in a trajectory where I've completely surrendered any and everything in my entire life. My career's gone. I guess they're coming back. We'll see.
Yeah.
And that allowed me to completely reinvent myself.
Yeah, man. Which we're going to, I mean, we got a lot to catch up on. I want to start with just the where this conversation started the other day. We met up and I reached out to for some of your services with your glass work that you've been doing. And we kind of started talking then. And we sat in Chesterfield. We were in a parking lot for a moment talking and just... it was nice, like just in, you know, pretty in-depth conversation for, you know, two guys in a parking lot. Like, but we started talking about grief because I just lost my pup a little bit ago and my 17-year-old Beagle Belle. And it was just a wild day, man. Like we're sitting there talking and then it was like a kind of a cloudy, rainy day all day. And then all of a sudden, the skies kind of open up, the sun, we got a big rainbow across the sky right above us. And
incredible. Yeah. I mean, the only way it could have been better is if the rainbow would have been coming off your head.
Yeah.
the weather matched the conversation. It started pretty somber. We started talking about grief because of the situation. Shane was dropping off some cremains, or ash, as some people call it, from his pup. And me and my partner put those in glass and make orbs, more or less a paperweight. I don't like to call them a paperweight because that trivializes really what they are. They're quite incredible sculpture, multiple designs, but we swirl cremains into glass orbs in different designs. And Shane had hit me up to order it, so we met up in a central location in Chesterfield. And man, I mean, the weather just matched our conversation. Start out sad. It's gloomy. It's kind of raining a little bit. And then as the conversation started shifting more towards healing and the power of art, connection, doing things like this, this rainbow fades behind you. And I'd probably be more freaked out if we were talking about the rainbow bridge and those kind of things connecting right. to, you know, people say that people go over the rainbow bridge when we pass, especially pets and things like that. And I'm sitting there and this rainbow's coming in behind you as we're shifting the conversation. And I'm just like, wow. And I was just telling you that, you know, that didn't really hit me until I'm driving home. And it's those moments in life that, you know, we live for, but, you know, just... wow. I mean, it's mind-blowing to be a part of such a thing. And yeah, it could have been just a random occurrence. Those things can happen. But man, they keep happening in my life. And
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people have the same experience. But wow, and to a beautiful sunset, which that has metaphors, mm-hmm. that the sun came out from the rain, but the sun was still setting. And, you know, grief is crippling. It's in the abstract. And, you know, I think it speaks to what's been happening, because I know a lot of people such as myself have had to grieve my career, have had to grieve what I thought my life was going to end up like, because all of a sudden this situation comes up, my careers are on hold, you know, destroyed or whatever. But wow, to experience life and to work with grief in a certain way, accept it and try to find the healing in it. And, you know, these glass things have been incredible with each and every client through the whole process, you know, getting the pictures or looking up the pictures of who we are memorializing, and just the process, you know, even some of the mundane emails going back and forth. I've had just the deepest connections and conversations with different people and different, you know, stages of grief. And a lot of people, grief is just in this weird abstract place. And when we can create something, it gives somebody something to hold, something to see, and be reminded of, yeah, this really hurts and it's really hard. But at the same time, if we honor it it can be very, very beautiful. And it still hurts. And it's still kind of sad because we'll never get over missing those people or pets or these things in our lives, you know, our careers. And to be honored to do something like this has really changed my life and really blown me away. And, you know, we've connected deeper on it. It brought us kind of back together.
Yeah.
You know, made it, because, you know, we get busy. We got to make a living. We got to do this. And sometimes we're separated. And, you know, it's these things that kind of start to connect us back up. And as hard as it can be, it reminds us that, you know, this life, love, and time together is so very precious. And if I can ever have anything to do with any kind of healing, I'm all about it.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It was, I knew whenever, like, the time came that this was what I wanted to do, because I'd seen your post in the past, and I was like, but I didn't really know how the whole process was going to work, but I'm, like, so grateful that I did it like this, and then turned her into artwork and like this. And, like, it's just a really powerful thing, man. Like saying, like you just described it. So I'm really, it's a cool way to honor them.
I say, you know, as a massage therapist, a yoga teacher, I've taught preschool. I've worked with a lot of different populations. And at this point, I'll say that art is the most healing, powerful healing tool that we have. Like one-on-one counseling, fantastic. I'd recommend it for everybody, whether you feel like you need it or not. Very powerful stuff. But art is pretty much a safe place to be yourself. And we'll draw things. And it's not even a matter of drawing things. Making art is a feeling, and we'll draw and paint and make stuff that we don't want to talk about. And I've studied art. I have a degree in art. And we would always, there's a cliche in art that everything you make is a self-portrait. And I've watched just stuff come out of people that they would never talk about. And you wouldn't look at their art to see this terrible thing that happened to them. You know, it's like a flower growing out of some doo-doo. You know, you don't focus on the doo-doo. You see the flower. But it's just so powerful to see and have that. And sometimes it goes through us. Like, you didn't make this glass, but, you know, while I'm making it, they kind of, you know, through that process of me and my partner, you know, making the glass, they make themselves. And, you know, to facilitate that, I feel a huge connection with my clients, even if I already know them. Whether they send me pictures or not, or, you know, some of my clients that, you know, have to drop their stuff off. So I haven't met them until I drop off their memorials. And man, it's just unbelievable how powerful art can be. Music's that way too, but it's a bit different. It's more immediate. When you're feeling, you're hearing that song and you're at that show, it's right there and you take it with you for the rest of your life. But an object is a little bit different. I mean, obviously, as an artist and musician, I love them both, and there's appropriate times. You could be looking at art and listening to music, which I'll talk about in a little bit on some stuff I got coming up. But, man, I'm just so touched, not just by you and whatnot, just the whole process of, man, having something to do with somebody turning the corner of grief and not feeling as heartbroken. And getting to the love part is very fascinating. And you know, grief brought me to my art careers, getting my stuff together, so to speak. You know, my grandfather died. And that, you know, at a certain age where I'd never been touched by death before, and luckily it came later in life where I could process it differently in art school, and my life was forever changed. I realized that this stuff is precious, time is precious, and that life is not a joke, and it's not something to take lightly. We don't want to take it too seriously because that starts to ruin it, and we get, you know, it just gets too heavy in the brain. But man, I mean, what a process and what a thing. I just really wish society would embrace that concept of making art, because so many times I've taught people that tell me they can't make art, and they tell me they can only do a stick figure. And when I worked at a open art studio for diverse, vulnerable people, you know, I'd hear that a lot. And I would just hand someone a small piece of paper and write, draw me 100 stick figures on this little piece of paper and tell me it's not going to be cool. Because no matter what, you draw 100 things on something, even if it's on the same spot, it when you're done, it looks cool. And I have a degree in art, and I can't hardly draw anything to make it look like something. But I don't care. It's the expression of it. My music is like that too. There's no songs in my music. We just jam. And it's like an abstract painting. Sometimes they don't turn out so well because they get muddy, so to speak, because there's too much going on.
Right.
But if you study that kind of vibe and get out of your own way and listen, you know, as much as, you know, the musicians and I play a lot of stuff, we're all listening intently, and that's really the difference. And yes, I have to deal with certain jazz skilled improvisational artists to do what I do, but you know, that's the beauty of it. It's just a free flow. It's not for everybody. Abstract art is, people look at Jackson Pollock's abstract splatter paintings and just be like, my kid can do that. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhat accurate, but not really. But, you know, some people dig that, and some people need a well-written song to get their groove. I get it. That's just not my vibe. But to be present and be in the moment is kind of what it's all about at this point for me. And, you know, that's really all we have.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I don't know. I just, I get like if people, I respond to like lyrical, you know, stuff for music more and stuff. Yeah. And that's just where I gravitate towards, but like, I get tired of people like talking bad about like certain things because like, it's just not for them. Like whatever, it's, you know, I don't like country music, I don't like rap music or what, you know, whatever it is. And it's like, just because it's not for you doesn't mean you have to even bash the whole thing, like whole genre of music and stuff. Like,
it's hard for people to just say it's not for me,
right?
Somebody's art. Took me a long time. Yeah. You know, and if you're just like, oh, country music sucks,
right?
You know, but it's mature to say, well, it's just it's not for me,
right?
Like, I'm listening to music now that I wouldn't have hardly given the time of day, like pop music from the 80s and stuff like that, to where I was inundated with it growing up and I couldn't appreciate it. Where now I can go, you know, that's a pretty good song. That's a cool melody. I don't have the nostalgia connected because I was listening to some wild stuff. But now I can, you know, listen to the radio and let Men at Work ride and just really appreciate the craft of it.
Sure.
And you know, the nuances of art and music to the different frequencies. What are they trying to say? I saw somebody post something last week about they didn't like musicians and certain people being political. And we got into a little chit-chat about it, because I don't mind at all. But we started talking about metaphor. That if you're overt with it, maybe something like Rage Against the Machine, just kind of, you know, there's some metaphors in there, but some people are very direct. But when it's, the politics are buried in metaphor, and there's more of an artistic approach that, you know, you're not beating someone over the head with it. You know, like some songs, I was like, I didn't even know that was about, you know, that the school shooting or whatever, some heavy thing. I was like, oh, and then you listen to it and you're like, oh, it's so cool. And I love it when artists bury things that you kind of have to find.
There's one of my favorites is Jason Isbell. He's got a on his record Southeastern. There's a song called Live Oak that about you know, he tells a story about you know, burying this woman there and all this, like, and it's just like crazy story, but all really what it's all a metaphor for him dealing with his alcoholism and you know, and bearing it, and like, you know, like he's sober now and he's been sober, and like, so it's like, but on the surface it's just this kind of like murder ballad kind of thing, and then like you realize like, oh, there's a lot, you know, it's all a giant metaphor for life. So
that's the potential beauty of art and how we express ourselves, you know, and the cliches versus, you know, deep stuff maybe no one would ever figure out. A friend of mine who's a tarot card reader, speaking of poetry, you know, Sylvia Plath is a very well-known poet, and she committed suicide, so everyone gravitates towards that. But she was into some deep stuff, and my friend had figured out that she buried a bunch of mystical tarot stuff in her poetry that no one had ever figured out. Julia Bramer did that. She used to run a local zine called Night Times back in the 90s here in St. Louis. Kind of like a different Shane back in the day, so to speak. Just loved the music and loved the scene and wanted to document it and have everything to do about it. You know, and podcasts are kind of the new magazines, you know what I mean? They're audio. But, you know, she found, because her husband, when she died, broke up the orders of certain poems she did. And then somebody re-released them in the correct order. And my friend is into Sylvia Plath and into tarot. And she's like, this is tarot. And the intellectual community, the kind of elite, you know, poet people, the Plath intellectuals, like, totally dismissed what she had done. And I don't know anything about tarot or Sylvia Plath, and it was obviously right there. And I just love the idea of somebody burying things like that and putting different levels of their art, because, I mean, what is art? You know, it's an expression to somehow elicit a response. And when I'm inspired to dig deeper into something of quality, I hope, because we don't want to look for, you know, something too deep in a Kiss song. But, you know, to your point, you dig a little deeper and you start thinking about it. And sometimes you do need to hear from that artist, because you won't figure it out.
Yeah.
But I just love that multi-level stuff of art. It just keeps me going, and it makes me want to do things like that. Yeah. Like when I'm in a body bag. I mean, there's any number of things that can mean grief, you know, death. With me, it was when I used, my sculpture teacher gave me a body bag out of the blue one day, and he goes, I think you'd know what to do with this. And I'm just like, actually, I do.
Right.
And I started coming out of the body bag wearing a diaper for my shows. My band, we would start like outside down the street or whatever, and they would carry me in on a body bag with a percussion parade. And they'd come and drop me on the dance floor and then hop up on stage and start playing. And then I would, you know, dramatically come out of this body bag in a diaper. And, you know, there's a lot there. It's relatively cliche for symbolism, but they wouldn't know that the typewriter idea came from my grandfather's death, and that I was reborn through his death. Hence the diaper. So I come out as a baby and I crawl on stage and I start performing. And all that stuff was happening at the same time of my life. Would anybody know that if I didn't tell them?
Right.
No. But that, who I don't care. As an artist, I didn't care then. And people just go, oh, that guy's being weird. That's good enough for me, because I definitely got people's attention. But the crisscross of all those things just utterly fascinate me. And, you know, a simple song could really convey endlessly any number of emotion. And painting and art is just a different form of music, and vice versa. You know, and to see, you know, a painting can speak to you differently every time you look at it, just like a song. And there's a feeling, and it's very different. So a perfect segue into what I've been trying to do artistically through COVID. I let the whole typewriter thing move away from me. Not only was I burned out before all this stuff happened, but as it happened, I just let go. And I started getting into throat chanting stuff. And we would integrate that with our shows for some time. We usually begin with throat chanting and stuff like that. And that tends to drone on and can get boring. But man, I just started doing this thing with the Funky Butt guys and Brennan England and John Heusler, a couple didgeridoo players there, and then Aaron and Adam from the Funky Butt. We really throat chant well together. And so we started doing these weird recordings of throat chant stuff, because I wanted to make music for my massage room, for my yoga classes and stuff. And we did this recording session, and it turned out so dark. But it was really cool, because it wasn't your typical airy-fairy massage stuff. It was like dark. We were all looking around going, man, this is not pleasant. And so we put out this cool record, which I'm going to release pretty soon, called Cave in the Mountain. I just like that concept of the cave in the mountain, kind of going back to the allegory of the cave and those kind of things. Once again, multi-layers of metaphors. So then fast forward to, you know, last year, Charlie Serpa produced the Cave in the Mountain stuff, and it was like one of his first projects as a producer, and he just did such a great job. And it was such a weird project, but it was perfect for him. And then we came back, and I wanted to do something with the chakra tones, each chakra through the body, the seven wheels in your body, the different colored wheels, you know, in a simplistic way. They all have a coinciding frequency. And so I was like, you know what? I want to come back to this make a massage CD music. I guess CDs aren't relative anymore, but I wanted to make this tone thing. And we tried to pluck some stuff out of some of the recordings we had done before and tweak it, but that wasn't working. And then Charlie's like, let's just try to have you sing a little bit. So I just had a little bit of a sample because the day we recorded, my voice wasn't in a good way. And I think we ended up for like six jams. I think there was like 30 seconds total that he chipped and chopped some of the tones when I nailed it, or he fixed what I wasn't, because my voice only has so much range, and certain those frequencies I can't hit.
Right.
Thank God for auto-tune. Like, we're not doing the pop thing with it. We're actually just fixing my tone and putting it in the right frequency. And the whole time I'm kind of working on this, I'm looking at the music industry completely shifting. And I was really concerned with it before the world fell apart. But then as it was falling apart, I'm really scared that people are going to get used to not going to shows, because they were slowly not going to shows before. And now that we can't, I was really worried. And everyone's like, oh, I think everyone's going to come back and really flood these places. And I'm over here going, I don't think so. I think we're getting used to not only staying home, but I think we're getting used to not spending the money that it takes and all this stuff. And I was being a negative ninny, and I was just, you know, looking at worst case scenarios for art and music. And so then I'm like, all right, well, I think I want to change the home listening experience. And at the time, you know, serendipitously, there's all these ads on Facebook and stuff that they had these colored light things that you could change the light in your house. And I'm looking at that, and I'm going, huh. And so I came up with this integrating of the five senses to make a sixth sense, meaning we made this record. We made these interesting tones without droning on. A lot of the tone stuff I'd been hearing is one tone for minutes, and it's kind of like meditating to me. If you're not familiar with it, it's kind of uncomfortable. It's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and do nothing. And I've studied it for so long, I'm more comfortable with that and kind of can clear my head,
right?
Because I've practiced a lot at it. But as a meditation teacher, people are looking at me going, it's quiet. What am I supposed to think about? And that's legit. And it's like, well, think about nothing. And it's like, what? Your brain's always moving. It's always thinking about how do you hold on to nothing? And it would be like, okay, focus on your breath and do all that. That only lasts a couple seconds. And you're like, you know, and when you're not used to it, you're like, you feel incompetent. And you are, because you're not doing anything. And so I wanted to make something not only where people could, I want to trick people into meditating, but to change the home listening experience. Because I started thinking about vinyl, and I started thinking about record players. When I grew up, you had to put a needle on a record. And I don't want to get all geezer on everybody, but it was a ritual. And I've been studying behavior change pretty intently the last few years. Like, I really want to understand not only what it takes for me to change, but how do you help people like achieve their goals and not get caught in what they don't want. And so ritual is a part of that. Create a ritual for yourself. You know, they say do something small, because I got 1,000 things I want to change in my life, and it gets overwhelming, and I don't change a thing. But if I do one little thing a day that changes, I can test it and see, is that working? How does that feel? If I don't drink coffee one day, how does that feel? I don't have to put this big, heavy burden on myself to stop and do this thing, because I love me some coffee in the morning, you know, and I have a thirst for stimulation, no pun intended. But putting these things together and creating a ritual that I connected to when putting Pink Floyd record and how it looked. And I was very present on the artwork. And we've lost that a fair amount in society. So I'm like, I'm gonna take that and go bigger with it. So we made these tones. And I'm going to make like a home listening kit where it has a light in it that changes color. I just found some at an affordable price, but you never know how these things work over time. Anyway, so this kit's going to have the record. It's going to have instructions. It's going to have something to change the color in your room, to do chromotherapy, how color affects our lives. Because if you grow up in a pink room, when you wake up, you're going to have a slightly different vibe than if you wake up in an electric yellow room or a fluorescent orange room. It's going to do something. You'll get used to it, but there's different psychological effects, not only with frequencies of music, but color. And then I'm like, well, let's not stop there. Let's integrate smell with it. So I'm going to put candles, scented candles and essential oils in this kit.
Yeah.
So that when you listen to the root chakra, you put on a red light, you put on this song. You use a certain essential oils and light a certain colored candle that coincides with the chakra. And then I'm going to put seeds or different dried food, then eat. So you're smelling, eating, hearing, and seeing something very different than you're used to. Even if you're sitting in your living room, you changed it to the color red. There's a candle burning in front of you that's red. You're smelling certain smells. You're eating strawberries or something that's red. And you've got these headphones on. And then there's this, you know, this weird tone going on. And you've immersed yourself in your own senses. And then what I've noticed is your brain starts to literally change. And you've created this multi-sensory ritual that kind of frees you up from your thought pattern because you're immersed in what you're doing. And you're literally not just thinking about something. You're tasting it. You're smelling it. You're hearing it. You're seeing it. You're immersed in it. And then the part of the goal is to then change the sixth sense in that, how do you feel? For some people, that might be spiritual. For some people, it might be purely scientific. Like, what am I feeling right now? And so right now I'm just waiting on mastering from Brad Sorno. Just, man, he's such good with frequencies. And there's certain medicine people that I want involved in this thing. And I'm about to hop on a motorcycle and travel around the country. And I'm going to build this kit in New York in a couple weeks. And then build some more in Atlanta now that I'm starting to find an affordable way to do it. And part of it's kind of gimmicky, where I don't think too many people are going to buy this kit. It's going to have a decent price tag on it because it comes with all this stuff.
Right.
But I just wanted to, you know, get people thinking differently, like artists thinking, like beyond just burning incense at a show. But what if people had I want to do a bigger scale, like integrative performance art where people come into a bigger room and do this ritual that I'm talking about. And I have a little more control over what people are experiencing, whether that's a wraparound screen someday, because 360 video is blowing up right now. And I want to get on that edge to, once again, change the listening and not just the listening experience, but the experience itself. I was talking with Grief with a friend of mine, Andrew Franklin's mother, actually, and he passed away. And we were talking about grief. And his mom is a medicine woman. I love her so much. And we had a really powerful sit down. And she said something that blew me away. She goes, life is about experiences. And it just floored me. It's a simple statement. It's nothing I didn't know. It's not groundbreaking. But it rooted me in, like, you know what? That's real. The experience might be tough. I might walk outside and step on a nail. But, you know, it's hard to find happiness in pain, but sometimes it breaks down to, man, I'm happy I can feel this, because if I couldn't feel this pain, I'd be dead by now. And reaching towards enlightenment, and what is enlightenment? You know, it's one of those really abstract things, but I think it is one of those things where you connect with where you are, and we're always there, but our brains seem to be just hell-bent on trying to control the future and trying to control the past, which is relatively impossible. But theory of relativity says it's all happening at the same time. And what that tells me is be in the moment. Then I can actually start influencing the future and healing the past. Because so much of us on a subconscious level are dragging around our crap. And it's, you know, our parents and these people didn't know any better. They're going by what was done to them. But those things can cause trauma. And that trauma word is pretty incredible too. It's thrown around a lot and it usually has to do with really intense stuff. But when you're a kid and you start reaching for that beautiful blue flame on a stove and someone smacks your hand when you're just being curious, that can totally change your life. And you can go from curious to worried about being punished. And then that snowballs into weird stuff. And there's nobody that's free from trauma. I don't care how well you lived. Even sometimes living well can be traumatic. Look at Siddhartha becoming the Buddha. I mean, Siddhartha was a prince. Very elegant lifestyle. Didn't have to lift a finger. And then saw something and wanted to go out and experience the world because Siddhartha knew that the experience he was getting was not the world, and went and saw what they call suffering. And, you know, finally, after all this journeying, someone goes, oh, you want to be enlightened? Go listen to the river. And it's like, what? And it was through that experience of listening to the river that made the Buddha the Buddha. And it is about accepting suffering. But when you accept suffering, you cease to suffer. And my uncle said something near the end of his life that just still just blows me away. He said, do not suffer. He goes, we sacrifice. And I just went, ah. Takes the little sting off it, mm-hmm. and takes the sorrow and the heaviness and goes, you know what? This is empowerment. And what does sacrifice mean? It means to make sacred. And it's like, oh, when you make suffering sacred, you're no longer a victim. You're empowered. And it's not about taking control of it. Quite the opposite. You accept it for what it is, and then you can work with it. And my uncle also said, don't fight with it, nephew. Dance with it. Boom, same stuff. You know, life gets hard, and we can butt heads with it, and we can fight it, and then it just hurts. But if we can accept it, then we can start to go, okay, some people would say some things are unacceptable, and that's accurate, but we still have to accept it if we're going to move forward and solve it. You know, we have to accept racism. And I think that's what some people are banging their drum on, like, hey, there's some serious problems out there. And I hear the other side that's going, no, you're making that problem. It's like, no, but if we accept it, that our history is treacherous and that human beings are terrible, then we can start to go, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? And that's what, like, my recent life is teaching me. And I got, like, through the situation, I don't even like to say the C word. I don't even like to call it what it is, you know. But through tough situations economically and health-wise, just, you know, across the world, taught me these things, not just to stay in the moment and don't take anything for granted, but to accept the situation, and then you can maneuver and pivot and make the adjustment. Because what I define health as the ability to adjust mentally, physically, whatever, and to accept that, you know, society is exposing a lot of its gross parts. And I got so frustrated because, you know, I saw just a lot of frustration and less emphasis on solutions, which is really easy for me to say as a white guy. But, you know, and then I started getting frustrated with what I thought other people were doing. And I was trying to distract myself from how I felt about how I thought I wasn't doing well. And then I got so frustrated, and then I asked myself, what are you going to do about it? And it just hit me. because that was a legitimate question and I really wanted the answer in my head. And then I decided to exemplify what I wish everybody in this country and world would do. And that is to connect back up and get back to local business, supporting each other in our own community. And instead of just pointing fingers, engaging as best as possible. And like through this whole, you know, pandemic situation, I was put in a rural situation. I had to go live with my dad out in the woods and surrounded by, how do I say this politely? People with a different perspective on such things as myself.
Right.
And I was in their world. And I'm like, man, all these people just go to Walmart. And driving around those areas, I would see these old retail strips empty. But the Walmart parking lot was full. Right. And I kept going, we slit our own throats. But in an economic situation, I was forced to shop at Walmart for a little while because I didn't have any loot. And I felt so terrible about that. And then once I got out of there, I'm like so frustrated, not just with myself, but with society. So I'm like, what am I going to do about it? And it's like, well, what was I born to do? And I was like, was I born to cut wood and fix foundations and work concrete and all that? Nothing against all that stuff. I love that stuff. I love manual labor. I'm not knocking anybody. In fact, through this whole situation, those are the cats that kept their jobs.
Right.
Where us service industry people were screwed. Anyway. And I just will, all right, well, here's what you're going to do. I had a vision. And I was like, I'm going to hop on an American motorcycle. And I'm going to go around the country. And I'm going to highlight nonprofits, small businesses. What are artists doing to survive? What are musicians doing to survive? I feel like we're losing, and rightfully so, the ideals of America. But then I realized if that's important to me, I need to do these things. And all these things just fell into place. Through the situation of the pandemic, I just threw up my hands and just said, I'm not doing anything anymore. I'm not running my career anymore. I'm not going to try to do anything. You know, I had the spiritual conversation with the great mystery, as I call it. And I said, I'm not doing anything. Whatever, you know, that proverbial, what do you want me to do? What's my purpose? And I says, you're going to have to put that literally in my lap. And days later, things started happening. I realized that I can edit video and I needed to stop needing someone else to do that for me. I'm going to do it myself. You know about that. And like days later, my buddy hits me up who owed me a favor and goes, I got a lap. MacBook Pro for you. And I'm like, okay, that's a sign. And then a buddy of mine saw that my phone was pretty old and busted up. And he goes out and buys me a big battery phone. He goes, you know, out in the woods, you're probably going to need this big battery. And I'm just like, wow. And it has been one thing after another. A Harley Davidson motorcycle basically fell on my lap.
Nice.
I've had to buy a few things. But it, you know, that's just safety stuff. But it's just been incredible to do these things and not do them and let life happen. Now, can you just sit in a room and expect someone to always bring you food and think your dream life is going to happen if you don't make any maneuvers for it? Of course not. Mm-hmm. But balance, the give and the take to spin it back around to these memorial orbs that I make is that occasionally I would get caught up in what I wanted. I need more money. I need, you know, this or that. I'm scared because my career, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing in a few years when I thought I knew, when we don't really know. But a few friends over a few days, you know, asked me, and this rarely comes up in conversation, and I'm talking about, you know, like I'm having a hard time, and they're like, well, how are you being of service? And I was kind of like, what? And they're like, well, how are you being of service? And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. And then I started doing daily videos, little yoga things to be of service, to at least help people breathe a little deeper, stay hydrated, and do their posture, because I believe those things are just the basics of health. And if we do those things, we'll see the hospital way less, and we won't have a lot of the problems that we have if people focus on self-care. But it's kind of funny, as human beings, we just grossly ignore the basic stuff that works, and we'll gravitate towards hyperbole, drama, that is just, a lot of it's just manipulative wheel spinning, I call it. Like, you know, I get it. Journalism has changed. These people are fighting for their jobs, and the only way they can keep their job is to be dramatic. If it bleeds, it leads, you know, and it's funny, this process, you know, sex sells, but there's not a lot of sex being sold right now. Because we have other priorities that supersede pleasure. But all these things come back together. And what I really love about doing the glass things is I can be of service beyond just entertaining or being weird and making people go, wow, that's weird. That guy's out there. But, that I can provide a service that people really appreciate and that I can get paid for it. And it's not like a negotiation. I'm not trying to manipulate money out of anybody. It's just a legitimate price for a legitimate service. And everybody wins. Everybody's so happy in that way. And to tie all that together in connection, and then to literally have an object, a circular orb that has somebody's remnants in it. Their DNA is in this magic glass. And glass is just an amazing medium. It's a there's a local person here in St. Louis, a master painter, Phil Jarvis. He's just...
Oh, yeah.
He is just...
Big fan.
Yeah. I was at Venice Cafe one time, and the owner of Venice Cafe said, you know, Phil's as good as any artist in history. And I was like... Nuh-uh. And he goes, look a little closer at his work. And so I did a deep dive into his paintings, and not just his sign paintings and what he chooses to paint and stuff like that, and was like, you know what? This dude is as good as anybody in history. Not only is he a cool guy, and a humble guy, just amazing artist,
right,
but his work speaks. And he told me, and he would know, he goes, nothing reflects color like glass. Nothing. And I thought about that. And I was like, you know what? That is right. It is a magic substance that... Still, I've been working with glass for over 15 years, and I still am memorized even by the most simplest part of that whole process.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Are you, when did the, you realize that these orbs, like, are something that you could do? Like, when is that idea? Because I know I've also seen some that you've incorporated, the typewriter keys,
yep,
in your sculptures and different things.
Yeah, we were doing that, and we were wrapping glass around metal, typewriter parts, which at the time, 15 years ago, I was one of the few artists in the world that was intentionally putting glass with metal, because it doesn't work. If they're touching... In the annealing process, which is a oven that brings the temperature down slowly over time, because if glass cools too quickly, it'll crack. It needs to, and that has to do with the outside's cooling at a way different temperature than the inside, and that creates tension in the glass, and it'll crack. But the annealer kind of soaks it in heat so it can have an even heat from the skin to the center so it doesn't crack. But through that process, if metal's touching glass, they start to create more tension.
Right.
I used to think it was the metal leaching the heat out of it, but it's just a surface tension that happens because they're just different materials. So we were wrapping and pouring glass around typewriters to different degrees with experiments and stuff. And I was thinking this morning, leading into this interview, I can't remember who asked about that first. Because where we do the glass locally, they didn't really want it happening there. Because it's kind of weird. You know, there's people's DNA and cremains are in the area. And that makes people uncomfortable. And I get it. But they let us do it. I can't remember the first person to ask me about that. And my glass partner, Aaron, he didn't want to do it. It's kind of creepy and it's kind of gross. The dust gets in the air. And so it's kind of creepy that everyone that I've done, their DNA is in my body. Because right. It gets in your eyes, it gets in your mouth, your nose, your ears. And, you know, glass powder does that as well. And we joke in the studio that once it goes in, don't come out. And so, you know, and that's part of why we charge what we do is because yeah. all that stuff goes into it. Like my partner, you know, when we started getting into it more of as a business, he just tapped on his chest one time and goes, "My lungs hurt." And I went, "Ooh, yeah, we should probably be using breathers."
Right.
We don't, but I don't mind. It really doesn't bother me. If I'll breathe glass dust, I'm not scared about someone's ashes. And it you know, it becomes a part of me.
Yeah.
Like I saw a picture, somebody, like when Mr. Bungle got back together, somebody took a whole bag of cremains and threw it on stage. And they had pictures of like this streak. And there's this giant bag of cremains that poof went around the stage, and anybody that posted anything about it, like nationally, Consequence of Sound and all this stuff, I'd always post like, "Well, your buddy wanted to be a part of the band. Now he literally is."
Yeah, right.
I would be so upset if someone made that choice for me, because people don't realize, you know, that's bone dust, what's left over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I choose to breathe it and work with it. But man, you can't make that decision sure. for somebody else. I bet that drummer in that band's pretty upset because it seemed to hit around him.
Yeah.
Now, is it going to do anything bad to you? No. You know, might affect some people, but it's just a fascinating process. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember who first did it. And once we started doing it, people were so touched by it. We kept getting more referrals and more referrals. I'm trying to leave town really soon, and I keep getting orders.
Nice.
So my bike keeps getting delayed at the shop, getting ready for this big journey. But I keep getting orders in, and I can't stop because I know what the experience is for everybody involved.
Yeah. You just did your first one for a turtle, you said, the other day?
We did a turtle the other day. Yeah. And we did, like, the time before that, we did an infant. And that really blew my mind. Because most people pets are smaller, obviously. But, man, to pull out just tiny little baggie with just a little in there really, really got in my head. And that was heavy. They're all incredible experiences. I don't care if it's a turtle or whatever. Like,
right.
It's a very, very powerful situation. But knowing it was an infant,
yeah,
it blew my mind, and I was touched by a turtle. And part of it's a mind job. I just thought these people love this turtle so much, you know. And certain animals, after living out in the woods, I care less about a squirrel or a rabbit because there's a gazillion of them. But you know, these people loved, and they told me the story of the turtle. You know, it was a rescue. It was dying. And this woman's husband nursed it back, and it was an albino, so it was going to have a harder time out in, I think it was old and albino, out in the woods, and the scales, you know, on its shell were falling off, thing was just busted down. And they sent me pictures and all that kind of stuff, and it really, really changed the experience.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fascinating, and the love people bring to the scenario is really what touches me. You know, and man, it's just mind blowing, and you know, it's just like work. Some days are smooth, and some days are tough. But every time we do these cremains, it's smooth.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like something else is doing it. That could be my brain just filling in the gaps or making it seem more grandiose or whatever. But I don't think so. These things, I've been in a lot of ceremonies and a lot of heavy spiritual situations, and I've seen this stuff kind of happen where it's like, man, my hands aren't doing this. And musicians can speak to that. And I think music is this incredible spiritual experience where musicians will tell you when they're in the zone, they're not telling their fingers what to move. And their fingers aren't necessarily doing the exact stuff they practiced. Like, it's almost like a phantom that comes in and takes over. And that's when the hair starts going up. And right. even what and the audience picks up on that. I mean, I've been in some jams that,
yeah.
you cannot write a song to get to where we went. And to hear my buddy Chan Evans and Dave Black going toe to toe smoked what I heard Hendrix do with these two guys. I was there, and of course that makes it feel, but it's just like, man, there's something else going on.
Yeah.
I respect atheists as much as anybody. I get it. I can believe in quantum physics just as much as I believe in the great mystery, but I'm sorry. I've experienced too much of this stuff that is what I put in magic or impossible.
Sure.
I've experienced too much of it to be like, yeah, whatever. There's nothing out there. And I do believe that that when we die, you know, we don't keep together, so to speak. I look at it like a drop of blood in the ocean. That when that blood hits the water, that blood never disappears. The matter that's in that drop of blood does not ever disappear. It just gets so spread out in the ocean that it's not that drop of blood anymore.
Right.
That drop of blood fuels something else, which fuels something else. I'm starting to get more into reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard about it and was like, yeah, whatever. And now I'm hearing about certain people's like experiences and what some of these mediums are reading in these people and how I feel.
Yeah.
Whoa. I don't know. I'll never pretend to know, but I think there's something to it.
For sure. There's a lot of, I mean, it's definitely interesting to think about some of the stuff.
Right.
There's definitely a lot of unexplainable things. I mean, I don't know about reincarnation necessarily, but just the way how perfect things kind of come together sometimes. Like, even thinking about all this, like, I lost a pup to cancer 7 years ago.
Mm.
And, you know, it was one of those kind of things where it was really tough. And a lot of people, like, afterwards were like, you know, I sent me links to, like, different adoption and foster things or whatever. And they were, and I'm like, I'm not really, like, looking to just replace my dog. And,
right.
You know, it wasn't like that. Like, and then I get a call from my vet. And of course, they knew the whole story, but somebody had, according to what they told me, a man brought a puppy in there, and that somebody dumped a puppy in his yard.
Mm.
And he's like, well, you know, didn't really know what to do, so he brought it to the vet. And then, so we get it. She's a pit boxer mix. We guess we don't have any idea, but
sure.
They were like, well, somebody dumped this puppy up here and she needs a home. And we thought of you guys. So I was like, it was just like one of those kind of things too. Like, it all just kind of like felt right. Like, especially when you're a vet and like believes in you as a dog owner and like, and all this stuff. But it was just like a weird, you know, it was really comforting, I guess, you know, in a sense, like it felt like, this just felt right. You know, especially like something tells us like this dog belongs here, and then we took her home and she's been incredible. But it's just like, it was really just a beautiful moment, you know, like everything that came together like that. So
we in our family, and I'm sure everybody has, a lot of people have this experience, that anytime we go get a pet, it never worked out. You know, like we went and got my mom this hound, and it was just the worst dog for her. And we went out of our way, you know, she loved the dog, but it was not a good mix.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I worked my network to find the absolute perfect scenario. This dog would not stop barking. Yeah. I mean, it was tough.
Sure. Like,
the dog was cute and awesome, but just, and it would get into these situations where it couldn't stop barking. Hours later, this thing is gone. And it was like, whoa, my mom was losing sleep and it just wasn't good. Man, I ended up finding the perfect owner for this particular dog. She still loves this dog, sends me pictures of it still.
Yeah.
And then a dog almost literally falls in my mom's lap, where, you know, my niece's roommate was a punk and moved out and left the dog. This dog is perfect for my mom.
Okay.
He actually saved my mom's life. I don't think she was doing too well, and this dog came into her life. And it's one of those dogs where the dog's facing the other way, doing nothing, and you just melt. The dog is like beyond cute. It's incredible. Snuggled with him this morning. But, you know, to that point, like when we don't open the door, when the door's open for us, that's right. A spiritual thing in my you know, however I look at it.
Yeah.
That going back to me surrendering and letting spirit do everything. I tried so hard to push my music career and my art career. And the harder I pushed, the less people showed up and the less sales I had. And now I'm doing decent business and making things happen in ways I never thought. And the doors are opening and it's just a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. The timing is right. And we don't know what we're being saved from or set up for. We want to control everything. It's natural because you can't just breeze it. But what a fascinating scenario. And I think pets are that very same way. You go out after it. It doesn't work. But when someone goes, hey, man, this chicken just showed up on my porch. Boom. I mean, that, you know, is that God talking? I don't know. Is that just random stuff? Maybe. I don't think so. Because you hear it too much. Like the Zodiac. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that when I was born or what planet is going on has something to do with my stuff. Man, the heck if that's not accurate. I mean, I don't care what you believe. You can't right. tell me that's that some of those personality traits. How in the world does that have to do on what day and time you were born?
Right.
What? But I think there's things in this world to remind us. Not in detail. You don't have to know that the House of Aquarius does blah, blah, blah. You know. But I think there's things out there that just give us signs. To just, if nothing else, I don't know why, to tell you the truth. Yeah. I don't know why this is the way it is. I don't know why I was born. I'm not going to leave this. Maybe my goal is to leave this planet better than I found it.
Yeah, man.
But I produce a bunch of waste. And how do you circumvent that, you know, on everything I've taken from this planet, even just as an individual? How do I give that back? How many trees have I cut down? How do I give that back? How much gas have I burned up? What? You know, but I think that's my goal. I'm not projecting my goals on anyone else anymore, but right. that's mine, is to achieve, how do I leave this place better than I found it? Doing what I do. And does that mean inspiring children? You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, philosophically, we can make the world better than we found it. But on a real sense, how do I offset the things I've taken from this world?
Right.
And you know, you can't beat yourself up over that, you know? But,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, create vibrations, create colors, move some stuff around. I like the old thing, I hear this. People, is it really, as a human being, all you're doing is moving stuff around your entire life, and it really doesn't amount to anything, you know? And it's just like, yeah. We're moving ideas around, we're moving things around, and in two generations, ain't hardly no one gonna remember you. I ain't yeah. gonna remember what you did. You're gonna be a name on this. I look at my family tree, and it's like, I enjoy thinking about these people.
Yeah,
I went weird.
I used to, one of my first jobs. I worked at Schnucks bagging groceries.
Yeah, man.
And I remember, it still sticks with me today. But
dude, that's a classic job.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Like my buddy met Steve Ewing from The Urge bagging groceries at a Schnucks. There that's how I found The Urge. And yeah. The Urge is my jams.
Hell yeah.
You know?
So I'm working there, you know, of course, you know, do my job bagging groceries. And this lady comes in and, you know, she's got a cart full of stuff. She looks at the you know, belt with the grocery. She looks at the, you know, whatever price tag, $100 or whatever. She looks at that and she's like, well, it's all gonna turn to shit anyway. So, and I was just like, yeah, you're right. So just like,
that's yeah. And you know, that's kind of an existential way to look at right. it. But it's I'm pushing lately a big time is balance. You know, balancing that out. Are we of service? But we can't just be of service, because then we can't do it. It's unsustainable. If we give too much away, then we don't have anything. And that was a big part of my year last year, was being in nature and being in the moment where I could walk outside and go, oh, what a pretty flower. And within inches, something was dead. Something, you know, and I'd be like, oh, what a cute little thing. And here comes a hawk, snatches that
right.
mouse. And I'm like, well, that's not fair to the mouse. We talk to the mouse. That's not fair. But nature is brutal. But it's also the most gorgeous thing there is.
Right.
And yeah, it goes to shit. And what grows out of that shit that's where the nutrients go back into the earth, and you don't want to smell it, you don't want to deal with it.
Right.
But the heck if I wasn't looking for cow shit to fertilize the garden, you know? And then it's kind of like, you know, like, well, I was talking to my dad that this dude recycled human shit for his garden, and no one wanted to eat his vegetables and stuff because they're like, nah, that's too close.
All right.
And apparently, you know, that was the jams. He had an incredible harvest. And then I was like, yeah, do I want to eat that?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, well, sure. You know, it's been repurposed and changed. But going back to that blood in the ocean thing, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you know, we're going to return to that.
Yeah.
You know.
So we're getting pretty close to you heading out on your adventure. And the motorcycle, you got the cameras, you got the computer. We're going to make a run at this thing and really get out there and showcase some of these. I guess to keep up with your adventures, follow along online and stuff? Or?
Yeah, like I'm in a weird place right now, kind of going back to that, you know, I'm not doing anything until the time is right.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to spit like my website and stuff right now, but I just did a photo shoot yesterday and I have another one set up that it's hard for me to make press photos until I have my motorcycle.
Right.
And I did a photo shoot yesterday. I was terrible. I'm so not a model. I'm so not a poser. It was so uncomfortable and it was so weird. And I know that came through and reflecting with it and talking with Virginia a little bit, Virginia Harold, who's the most brilliant photographer you could ever come across. Virginia Harold, man, I can't say enough of good things. Kind of to that Phil Jarvis thing. Mm-hmm. She's as good as any photographer in history. And she has just, she's a medicine woman. And she just has a way of capturing, like, reality and life.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, I was real stiff and off my game yesterday and realized that I need to be photographed doing things. Anyway, so the website's kind of waiting for photographs. Because all the photographs I've had from before are all about music and art.
Right.
And those are a part of where I'm going, but they're not the push. So I need a little more stuff on me. So I'm building all that stuff as we speak. But, you know, search for Typewriter Tim and these things will come up. I'll come up. And those things will definitely be coming up as time goes on.
Yeah, man.
And right now, I always have to be careful because my brain goes a million different places, like a lot of artists and people. So I have to be careful what I commit to. Is it going to be Typewriter Tim? I'm not Typewriter Tim so much anymore. Typewriter Tim is my sounds kind of weird, but like my personality is splitting into different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
To where, you know, there's the yoga teacher, there's the massage cat, there's Typewriter Tim, there's Type Jordan, which is different than Typewriter Tim. And so as these things kind of come together and also come apart at this time, I've got to see how the media kind of starts building itself. And I have to be careful because whatever I commit to now is going to be how it is. So, and I don't even know if typejordan.com is available anymore. But, you know, that's the beauty of today. I don't think anyone looks up stuff. They usually just run a search. So
right.
Run a search on Typewriter Tim.
Yeah.
Or Kookball riding his motorcycle around the country. But yeah, I'm just waiting for the bike and then taking the cameras. And I'm just going to be documenting all that. I'm going to be documenting doing the website. I'm going to document, you know, getting my audio gear ready because I'm going to get into podcasting such as yourself. And I want to be a documentarian of America and what I love about America. So luckily I'm heading to the East Coast. I've got a kind of a pseudo residency at a art gallery in Frenchtown, New Jersey. And she's going to let me live there, but I'm also going to do performance art there because I kind of don't have a job. And it's like, what else am I going to do? Being on media is my job. So I'm going to roll around in her gallery in the body bag when there's no one in it. And when there's someone in it, I'm going to retreat. And I'm going to put a 360 camera on the ceiling or something like that so people can live stream and kind of see where it's going to be. I'll be on YouTube, Typewriter Tim on YouTube. And coincidentally, I found another Typewriter Tim.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. The friend suggestions on Instagram. I saw Typewriter Tim 1.
Huh.
And so I emailed him. I'm like, you don't play a typewriter, do you? And he's like, no, I collect them. I'm like, okay, cool. Because I always joke that if I found another typewriter player, we would battle. And whoever won gets to keep going. And whoever loses has to stop. So luckily, Typewriter Tim in Chicago doesn't play a typewriter, or I'd have to go battle that guy. And I'm actually probably going to give him typewriters at some point, because I'm trying to unload my hundreds and hundreds of typewriter, because all of a sudden I'm not going to make as much sculpture out of them as I see it. And I moved out of the house I was living in, and they're heavy. And I've got a lot of them. I mean, I scrapped at one point. I scrapped almost 900 pounds of typewriters.
Whoa.
I got like $25 for that stuff. I was bummed about that. I thought I was going to get more. And those were just my electric ones that didn't look very good and didn't have too much of my purposes. I kept most of my old iron ones and most of them. But it's kind of funny that people ask me for typewriters and like none of mine work. None of them. They're all either in disrepair or just gummed up from rust. But anyway, so yeah, I'm heading to the East Coast. I want to see New York for the first time, and I want to ride through while I can, because traffic is more sparse now, to where my buddy's like, you need to come here. Because originally I was going to document American music, jazz, country, rock and roll, the blues, and how that all came to be in America. And then I got, that was a too big of a project for me, but that's what I was going to go for. And then my buddy goes, you need to come to New York now. It's empty. It's going back a couple months. And I'm like, ooh, yeah, I need that footage. So I shifted gears and I'm going to the East Coast. I'm going to run up on some of my artist friends. I have a proposal that I worked on before with one of my buddies, Clip from the P-Funk All-Stars. I was talking to him. I had the bass player from Fishbone, Norwood, agree to work with me. And what I was going to do was put together this crazy jazz funk band and raise equipment for East St. Louis schools in the honor of Miles Davis and Bitches Brew, his dope improvisational record. And the guys from Bad Brains said they'd do it. Norwood was in. We were just going to start talking to Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction. And everything was a go. And then I had no budget for it, so things had to stop. But as things are right now, I'm going to pick that project back up. So probably tomorrow I'm going to call Clip. Because all the Bad Brains guys outside of HR live in Woodstock. So I'm going to go to Woodstock. And I can do this. I can just ride up there and try to talk to these cats. And now we can just wave a little money, and artists need gigs. So I'm like, hey, you know, can you guys do this? And so I'm going to see what they say. I don't care anymore.
Right.
What are you going to say? No. And these people aren't doing as much. You know, if I tried to run up on these people, you know, 5 years ago, they got stuff going on.
Yeah.
They're playing gigs, they're making records, they're doing whatever they need to do. Where now, even still, it's like, no, we got some time and we need some money. So I'm going to go after my acquaintance Speech from Arrested Development in Atlanta. I'm going to try to roll up on him. I went over to his house one time when I lived in Atlanta. He invited me over. He produced a Citizen Kings record, and I was really good friends with those guys and loved their music. And then Speech was in Atlanta, and he came in the restaurant I was waiting tables in. So I walked up to his table singing one of the songs he produced. And he's like, hey, how do you know this song? And I was like, yo, those are friends of mine. And so we hit it off, and he goes, hey, man, I got this church where it's for artists and musicians and stuff. You want to check it out? And I was kind of like, about that, but I was like, hey, someone invites me somewhere, if I can go, usually I'll go, or at least I was at that zone. I feel like artists are more accessible right now, and there's a, you know, I can't call him a buddy, but I'm a fan of the old band 24/7 Spies, and Jimmy Hazel is in New York, and I always watch him on Facebook and see, he's just a really nice guy, like, wish me happy birthday, and you know, you hear from your music heroes from your youth, and they wish you, like Rude Boy from Urban Dance Squad, you know, took a moment to say happy birthday to me, and I was just like touched by that stuff, so I'm like, I'm just going to run up on these people, and I wasn't going to take my typewriter with me. Just because, I don't know, I was burned out, and I'm just don't want to play the typewriter anymore. But the typewriter works, and it's really a part of who I am. So then I'm just going to take my player typewriter with me. It's small, lightweight, and cool. And I'm just going to roll up on these people and email them, hey, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And see if Jimmy Hazel will just bring an acoustic guitar down the steps for 5 minutes. And I'm going to pull up on my motorcycle. And me and him are just going to have a jam for just a little bit. You know, pound, you know, fists or whatever. And then whatever goes on from there.
Right.
And I think now more than ever, artists are like, yeah, sure, I'll be right down.
Right.
You know, I'm not trying to exploit them or try to get any free music off them or whatever. It's just kind of like whatever. And, you know, those are the kind of moments of life where we just get out of our own way and go, yeah, there's no reason why I wouldn't go down the steps today or down the elevator to play typewriter with this kook ball rolling around the country. Why not? And if we can help each other out, you know, cool. And I'm on a tear. I feel bad because I played music for a really long time. And most of my bands were mostly white. And I look back and was reflecting last year on things. And I'm like, you know what? I wish I would have made a greater effort to have different kinds of people in my band. And St. Louis is a fascinating place in that realm where, you know, the redlining and physical divide is not the only divide in this city, you know. And I'm like, man, I wish I would have played with this person or that person. But, you know, you kind of just deal with whoever's in your zone. And I have a weird way of booking the musicians in my band where it's kind of like I'll work with a certain guitar player until they can't make it. And then I'll work with a different guitar player until they can't make it.
Right.
And, you know, some people make an effort to make it all the time. And, you know, some people, you got a better paying gig. Yes, please go do that because I can't pay you much because my bands are notoriously huge. So I was like, all right, well, then just do that then. And so as I leave, as I'm working out some of my gear issues and my motorcycle issues, I'm going to start here in St. Louis and start rolling around and talking to people. And I want to flip the script a little bit where if like 80% of the country or this region or whatever is white, I'm going to flip the script and do 80% non-white. And I've been watching a lot of or listening to a lot of conservative backlash on what society's trying to do. And the quote right side is trying to say, oh, it wasn't racism until you people started complaining about it. And it's like, no. But how do I circumvent that? And so I'm just going to make an effort. And we were talking when we were setting up. I'm going to start my own podcast. And it's called Honky's Gotta Honk. And it's about not only how white people are in this country. And in parentheses, you know, Honky's Gotta Honk. And it's like how to be a good white person. Because I hear on this conservative stuff that people go, well, what do you want? What does it look like when we find racial unity? And I'm like, it's when we listen. And that we is a big we. That's not just white people.
Right.
And I was really touched by something I heard from a couple Native American writers that were writing this article together. And they said, can you people just please put the stereotypes aside, good or bad, and just listen to our stories? And I was so struck by that, the power of listening. Now, I joke with you, I'm the guy who can't shut up. You probably tell, listen to this. This guy can talk. But part of Honky's Gotta Honk is that I always have to talk. And when I'm uncomfortable, I have to try to control that and talk over that and try to just try to, you know, do whatever games I need to do to not feel comfortable. And what I've really learned lately is listen. You want people to listen to you. That's why you talk. But we need to listen. And I explained to some of my knucklehead white people on some of these concepts where, you know, I'm like, well, when were you listening? Because we're quick to talk. That's that honky's got to honk. We have to honk. And like honky, the word honky, you know, it came to me through George Jefferson, but it was explained to me. It wasn't honky tonk, which is where that comes from. It was someone explained it to me on how white people, and it's not just white people, have to honk their horns.
Oh, yeah.
That we're impatient.
Right.
And we think we're important, that we need to honk our horns to get people out of our way. And I was struck by that metaphor. That's what I thought honky meant for decades until I looked it up and was like, what actually does that mean? Because I was explaining to people, you know, whip cracker. That's what, you know, cracker comes from. But it also has other roots. And I was like, you know, honky's got a honk. I'm like, I like the idea of being forthwith about how, quote, we are, and that we always have to honk our horns and those kind of things. And I want to tie that in. And I also want to empower people. And I also want my people, my white people, to listen to other people's perspective on how to be a good white person. And a lot of it boils down to be quiet and listen. You know, different people have different attitudes about how to make this right, because our history is treacherous. And I don't want to whitewash it, so to speak, by saying, well, the natives all fought and whatever tribe had whatever land, they took it from someone else, which is a legit point. But it also negates the personal situations that people have. And I was explaining it to my one buddy the other day, because he brought up the whole All Lives Matter thing. And I'm like, dude, if you went up to someone and said, I have cancer, and their response was, well, a lot of people get cancer. A lot of people, you know, blah, blah, blah. You just totally negated where that person's coming from and what they want. They want healing.
Right.
And when people say, man, I'm tired of this history and I'm tired of these things happening. Number one, if you just negate it, you didn't listen, you didn't learn, and no one's going, okay, well, what should we really do to make it better? Some people are, but, you know, it gets lost in the mire. And you know, I want to create better media, as do you, at a time where media is getting worse. And I can't be mad at a journalist for trying to save their job. And if they can save their job by doing sensationalized things, yeah, you're trying to save your job. I remember I saw the youth minister of the Nation of Islam did a speech at KU, University of Kansas, when I was there. And he broke it all down. I was blown away. He goes, you take care of your family first, right? If the fit hit the shan, you'd protect your family first, right? And it's like, yeah. And then it's like, well, who's after that? Well, your secondary family, and then your friends, and then your acquaintances, and then strangers you think are cool. And he broke it down like that. And I was like, you know what? That is right. He goes, I'm not mad at you white people for all this. He goes, you're just protecting your family. He goes, yeah, but you take it too far. And people get hurt. That's a different story. But, you know, that breakdown was really powerful. And then it's just like, all right, well, what am I going to do about it? But if, you know, I don't want to be another white guy exploiting other cultures or exploiting someone's situation to better myself. But that's the beauty of media. It's whatever you want. And I want to create good media at a time where I'm hoping people are thirsty for better media. Because coming out of this Trump stuff, pro or against, it's a mess. I lost a lot of respect for people left and right through that whole experience and that mental civil war that's going on. And it's like, all right, well, how do I be a good white person? I'm going to go explore that. And I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to be a good white person. I want to ask these people who I respect, what is that? How can I be a better white person? Right. I'm just fascinated by that subject. And I don't think we're asking each other good enough questions now. I think we're reacting to situations, powerless situations, and that's natural. But I'd like to see, and people talk about dialogue and conversation. I'm like, that's important. But what does that look like in actual action? You know, how many people are going to nonprofits that actually do work in justice? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We're caught in, oh, that person did that, and that sucks. We need to shame them and do all the things, which is legit. But it's like, all right, well, then what? You know, and then some people are like, well, the justice system is the one that created all this mess. It's like, yeah, all right. You know, how do we fix that? Ah! And I realized that most people, including myself, aren't going to do a ding-dong thing. And then I went, well, that ain't good enough for me. How do I combine who I am, what I do, to that goal, going back to what we were discussing earlier? How do you leave this place better than you found it? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've come across some bigots at my time out in the woods with my dad. And I could have just went, get out of here with that knucklehead bullshit. But I actually engaged them and just kept asking them a simple question. Why do you care? Why did you bring this up? You know, because a couple cats wanted to talk to me about race. I'm like, you're out in the middle of Whiteyville. Why are you bringing this up? Mm-hmm. I go, you've been watching Fox News again, haven't you? You know, and I'm like, why do you care? And they would never answer the question.
Right.
And I go, well, what's, what, why are we talking about this? I go, I don't know why you're talking to me about it, because it's obvious how I feel about it. But sometimes there's an opportunity to unwind that crap. Because I had a buddy early on. I dropped an N-bomb in the car with a black guy. And he's like, car got quiet. Now, he doesn't remember this. And maybe my memory's skewed and grandiose. But he goes, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, oh, man, I'm sorry. I just shooting off my mouth. He's like, yeah, I know that, but I want to know where that came from. And I was just like, whoa. And I kept trying to apologize my way out of it. Oh, I'm stupid, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, I ain't talking about that. What did you actually mean by that statement? Let alone saying it in a car with a black guy, you fool. And I was sitting there going, I'm about to get my ass beat, and I deserve it. And he goes, you can either get out of this car or you can tell me what you meant by that. And I just went, you know what, man? My dad's a bigot. I grew up around bigoted people. I'm ashamed. And he just goes, fair enough. You say that shit again, I'm going to beat the fuck out of you.
Right.
He's one of my best friends still to this day.
Yeah.
That moment changed my life, because I went home and I'm like, your mama raised you better than that. That ain't who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could start to unpack how we pick up stuff and how that actually caused me trauma. You know, I'm not going to compare it to other people's real trauma. It's some privileged white people shit right there. But I reflected and I go, that ain't me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be that person. That person sucks. Is that who I am? No. And so after that, I use that experience to engage someone who will listen. Some people won't listen. Some of these knuckleheads, I'm not going to waste my time. It's not going to do any good. And those knuckleheads that I dealt with not too long ago out in Owensville on these conversations, did they become really great cultural diverse people because of a conversation with me? No. I had the time and I wanted to make them look stupid. But I can relate, because I was not quite to that extent. I was that dumbass a long time. I just shoot off my mouth. Gay this, fag, all that shit was all socially acceptable when I grew up. And now I look back and I'm like, man, who's that? Because right. That ain't me.
Right.
So we grow. Can we connect? Once again, I love music and I'm not a sports guy. But what I love about sports is people who play sports don't care about that stuff anymore, because they're in the locker rooms with their, and they become brothers or sisters or whoever, and friends and loved ones. And that's when it changes. Music's the same way. We're a little polarized here in St. Louis in so many ways, and in the music scene, which makes me kind of sad. But whatever, I'm going to embody that. I'm going to bring together, you know, people to play with of all backgrounds. Native music fascinates me. I want to find the roots to that and listen to the stories of that. But to go through those processes of connection, can we bring these people in? Who are we frustrated with? We're frustrated with a bunch of jerks. Okay, well, how do we motivate those jerks to not be jerks? Well, we can segregate them and go, just get out of here, shame them down. So they're going to go out in the woods and train and get together with a bunch of other knuckleheads. Or we can engage and earn respect. Like I said, some people are beyond that. But some people might be able to be reached. And, you know, Black people and natives and people of different cultures have to deal with that stuff day in and day out, and they don't choose to do it. So I feel like it's part of my duty as a good honky to, you know, work with it and try to do something and connect people, inspire them to be better. And like with everything going on now, everybody wants to control what scares them and powerlessness. It's natural. When we feel powerless, we'll take control in any way, shape, or form. But I was talking to Virginia, waiting in line to get our COVID shot. And I was like, we can motivate, inspire, or we have to let it go. And it's like, man, you know, mandates and stuff like that are tricky. In one hand, people are so stupid that they need to be told what to do. They had to mandate seatbelts. You shouldn't have to mandate seatbelts. It should be just like, hello. And people still resent that. But, you know, I was talking with another friend who was frustrated by mandates yesterday. And it's like, how much is a life worth? How much is an extra day with someone you love worth? I go, talk to me about how one more week with my mom would mean to me when we're talking about careless behavior. Now, is my answer to mandate that? Mine isn't. But I'm not mad at anyone who goes, people are stupid. We have to mandate or they won't get it. I would have liked to have seen something else happen. Like back in the day, big campaigns of be smart, you know, or donate rubber. Don't use this. Give it for the cause of world war, whatever. We've lost that. We've lost it for the fight hyperbole of journalism and the 24-hour news cycle. And then the social media, what that did to the 24-hour news cycle. It's like, man, whoa. We should be evolving better. But once again, if I have that, what am I doing?
Right.
You know, I got to go out there and I got to go live my life and make something of myself. And hopping on a motorcycle is my way of doing it. Because I do a million different things. In my business, I was getting some business counsel. And they're like, dude, you have to pick one thing. And I'm like, you don't understand.
Right.
And then I just immediately went, video. And my friend goes, exactly. Then you can do all that stuff. As long as there's a video camera there, you're still falling into your business plan. Going back to what we were talking about, balance. That I can't just be an artist and expect, oh, a manager's going to show up, a documentarian's going to show up, and then your fans are going to show up. It works that way for some, usually more in history than now, but it's like, no. You gotta do the business. And I've been fighting that forever. And now I'm more apt to do the business and the balance part of that, to hold a business plan, making a plan instead of just making stuff, making music, making records. Because we as artists can, a lot of times we make something and then we're done with it. And like, I'll make a record.
Right.
And then not touch it. But I'm about to release all that stuff real soon. And I don't care anymore. It's not for my career anymore. It's just like, well, I made this stuff. I want to get it out now. It's just, I was avoiding the work part of it, the business part of it. Cause I'm an artist. I just make stuff. It's someone else's job to do these things.
Yeah.
And it is, but it's not, I'm not that lucky. I don't know those people. I don't have those resources. So now I finally got out of my own way. I said, handle your business as well. And get out there and do it. And if it doesn't work, if I get to Indiana and that bike breaks down, I can just hitchhike back here and start doing foundations again.
Right.
I know it's not going to go that way, but I have no fear. I'm going into the abyss, so to speak. But I also have faith that my friends won't let me fail. Yeah. And that's real.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what this journey takes you, man. Like, see what's next for Tim, and get hopefully this music coming out soon and everything else. So we got a lot of things happening, and but I'm proud to call you friend and be a part of this with you, man. So,
and you know how I feel about you, Shane. I'll go on for another 2 hours on how what cool cat you are and what you're doing for all of us. I told you this on the last one.
Yeah.
You're good glue, man.
Well, thanks,
you keep
brother.
Us all together, because we will just keep making records and drift around and do whatever. And it takes people like you to really help us keep reaching the people and do what we're born to do. I mean, a lot of us have a bend for living forever. And it's these documentations that, you know, if I ever have a grandson or someone else down the line might hear some of this stuff. And once again, going back to, if we can inspire just one person in our life to be better and do better and maybe, you know, quell some pain, that's a life worth living. And, you know, I've watched you, and I did this last time. You know, I'm going to speak for everybody, man. We love you and we appreciate you, man. And it's just an honor to be here. I love telling you things. I ain't going to tell nobody else in no other way.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of this is a scoop, but I didn't want to talk about my music and color and five senses to six. I wanted to drop that because I didn't want anyone to take my idea. But, you know, talking with you, man, I want that documented here. And I've told you, man, you're getting this time and our time here to document some of the greatest talent in any city in any time. This town is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
I just hope there's, you know, and you're taking the market bigger than St. Louis, and that's what it needs. There's a neo jazz soul thing happening in St. Louis and all kinds of stuff that is unreal. I don't know what's happening in New York. I'm about to go find out, but St. Louis is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I just wish there was enough people to sustain it, but we won't quit either. Right. We're going to keep doing it because we have to. It's who we are. So thank you for documenting us and supporting us. That is money in our bank, literally and metaphorically, that without people like you, we don't get to keep doing it. We got to go, you know, schlep some burgers or do whatever we do. And that's no fun.
Right.
Love you, man.
Yeah, I love you, Tim. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for everything. And I'm really, really happy with everything with my orb. And so thank you
for doing it. Dude.
Yeah, appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, man.
Right on. Well, have a good day, buddy. I'll see you soon.
Cheers.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Well, yeah, that was it.